Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Say you stand by your man. Tell me something I don't understand. You said you love me, and that's a fact. And then you left me, said you felt trapped. Well, some things you can't explain away. But the heartaches in me feel this day. And stand by me.
We're back about 5 minutes into hour two on this Thursday, and Tony Black joins us after a really fun weekend in Philadelphia, highlighted by the Pennsylvania Derby Day. Kind of an unexpected result, but that's why they put him in the gate. And Tony, really a wonderful day. Thanks to you and Kai and you know, everybody that made it another really special afternoon. Hot and sunny and big crowd. It really feels like a big day at the racetrack, Pennsylvania Derby Day.
Yeah, it really was, Steve. Thanks for that, Kylie. She came through with us for us. Getting us situated. But it was a really interesting day. It kind of muddied up the waters when it comes to three-year-old division. The boys, in my eyes, I mean, I'm not saying it didn't clarify something, but in my eyes it did. You know, it was an interesting race. It was an interesting day. And you're always glad to see a lot of people out there. And the place was packed. We couldn't fit anybody else in there. The race was kind of, and you know, I've missed the last few broadcasts, and I was tuning in this morning, and I don't know, I couldn't get you. But I was working the last few broadcasts and didn't get home in time to listen to what you've had to say. So I'm like in the dark about Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But the thing that got me with the times of the races in general, you know, there was a race, it was a split of a maiden special race. Right? Going 7/8 of a mile. The first division went like 23 and change, 24. The second division went in 27 and change. I'm thinking, that's the split of the same race, the same distance. The times were weird when you look at that. And then, you know, we look at the Derby, and of course, Mike Smith's horse had an excuse, improbable the way he broke. But what really impressed me at the, you know, when it came to the times and Math Wizard, when he came running past horses that were walking the dog in the early fractions, usually the good horses, when they're going those kind of fractions, pick it up when somebody comes to them. And he kind of blew by them. And it's always impressive when you see slow fractions and a horse come from off the pace, run by the slow fractions. You know, that's impressive when a horse does that, if they were the fractions. The times baffled me. I'm still trying to figure out the times. But, you know, that's what the teletimer said, so you got to go by what the teletimer said.
Well, because I looked at the times too, and it felt like it might be a tricky day to make figures. Dick Girardi makes the buyers anyway for Philadelphia for Buyer Associates and has forever. A day like that, Tony, when it's that hot, I mean, it was 90 plus degrees, and they were watering the track. They were trying to keep the track, you know, as wet as possible. But you do get odd, you know, odd composition, you know, when especially more typically at places where there's turf races in between. And you know, they don't really run as many turf races at Philly on a day like that. There was the Turf Amazon. They don't really, you know, you don't have those hour and 20 minute spreads, you know, between dirt races where sometimes the track can get cakey or cuppy and you know, clumpy depending on when the water was put on it and when it was harrowed. I mean, what's your experience at Philly like that in general?
To me, it was really out of sorts. I couldn't figure out anything when it came to why they were so different, especially when you looked at the maiden race. I think it was a filly race. The split of the race ran 3 seconds different. It's the same kind of horses. Are they that much different? Or is it like, as you were saying, the time frame, the ordering? But, you know, to say that the watering of the racetrack causes something, well, you know, watering of the racetrack on a hot day doesn't make maybe extreme amount of difference, and maybe it did that day. But windy days make an extreme amount of difference when it comes to watering the racetrack, because the wind is what dries out a track, not the heat. But maybe they were saturating it as the day went on. Maybe the track got slower because the times were not impressive in the Derby, absolutely not impressive. What was impressive was if they were the times, correct times, the horse that run past those horses was impressive. But, I mean, he isn't even on the chart when it comes to three-year-old championship. And, you know, Improbable was the only horse in the race that really had an excuse. But, I don't know, you could have hit on something, you know. You could have hit on something when it comes to heat and humidity and the watering. Maybe that caused a difference in the times. But when I went back and looked and I saw a split of a race and the times were that much different, it baffled me. I'm thinking 3 seconds is a lot of difference in time for a split of the same kind of horse.
Well, and what, you know, one of the telltale visuals when this happens, when you get a racetrack that's getting, you know, heavily watered to try to keep it, you know, from getting baked, essentially, you, a lot of times you'll see horses that, you know, even though it's been a beautiful day and, you know, there hasn't been any rain or anything, you'll see horses that were rallying and horses that were behind horses. They come back caked with mud and right. with dirt. And you say, how's that possible? How is there a coating of wet dirt on these horses when it's a beautiful day? And it's because the water is underneath that surface and underneath, you know, the top layer that has gotten a little, you know, a little fluffy from the sun. But the water has gotten down, you know, further into the cushion. And that's what's getting kicked up, the spray.
Yeah, you're absolutely right when it comes to that. On many a day that was a dry day and they're hitting the track with plenty of water, you know, you'll have 3 pair of goggles and you'll go past the top. You'll go through the top there. No, you do that. And then if you look at horses when they come back, especially you look at the neck to the chest, and they'll be covered. And the jock's pants, will be covered, you know. And that is... Yeah, you know, that's kind of like standard on days like that when it's they're hitting the track and trying to keep a lot of moisture in it. Because you're talking about cushions that are primarily clay at that time, this time of year. As you get into the later months and we get into the cold, freezing temperatures, that clay becomes less and less because they cut it with sand and they take the clay mixture and really dilute it with sand. Then, you know, then it's hard to keep a track moist, but it's also in the wintertime with the freezing temperatures, it's easier to bust up. You can't bust up clay when it freezes as easily as you can bust up a basic sand combination with some clay in it, you know, and it doesn't hold the water. Absolutely right. Clay surfaces, cushions, they hold a lot of water. And like I said, the sun, where it hits, especially through the lane, you're talking about the shadow of the grandstand at Parks Yard. I don't know other races. The shadow of the grandstand does shade the sun. You'll see a shadow of the grandstand through the stretch in the late afternoon or the afternoon. And you can keep it moist. It just was weird, the times, and it was just something I focused on, and it probably means nothing. But, you know, so it was something to think about. That's all I'm saying.
No, there's no doubt. That racetrack, invariably, whenever we come away with the postscript from Cotillion Derby Day, there's some consideration because it is such an unusual place year round, whereby the rail is almost invariably bad, and you know horses typically come from off the pace and rally wide. I mean that's the track profile year in, year out, but there have been Derby Cotillion days where the inside is okay. And it seemed that the inside was actually okay Saturday.
Absolutely. In fact, before the first race, I was talking to Ron Dandy, and I breezed horses that morning. I said, I look at the rail. I'm not going to say it's the best part of the track. I'm not going to say it's golden, but the track has an even bias from the rail out. Now, as you got to the middle of the track, he must have graded the rail out. And you could see where he graded the rail out because it leaves a ledge on the inside of the inside fence, which I always notice if it's been graded out because of that ledge that exists. Now, as he graded out, they leave dirt on the outside, but he leaves it past the running part of the outside. And
over the crown.
John, yeah, over the crown. Or at least onto the crown or just past the crown, right. So I said, if anything, the track has an even bias. If you get too far out, you're going to get into the slow going where he left some of the dirt lying when he graded it out. But in general, you don't get that wide unless your horse is bolting. And unless it's Broad Rush coming to the head of the stretch and bolting. Bringing back memories of Broad Rush. He bolted, lost the lead, came back and win like a good thing. You know, I broke his maiden and won an allowance race on him. He didn't do a thing wrong in the maiden race. The allowance race, Broad Rush tried to bolt with me. I just barely kept him in enough and wound up winning the race. A couple weeks later, I was hurt and couldn't ride him. He ran in Merlin at Laurel. I think Danny Wright rode him. Then a few weeks after he'd run, I got back to riding or whatever I was. I forgot what I broke or what I broke. But I went down to Merlin to ride something. Danny Wright said, this son of a gun, I think it was Danny Wright who rode him. Whoever the jock was, I think it was Danny Wright. He said, he lugged in so bad I couldn't let him run through the lane. And I thought, boy, what a common son of a gun. You know, he had a mind of his own. But it brings back memories when we talk about the crown of the racetrack and the surface of the racetrack. And, you know, Pennsylvania Derby's been a good race, you know, every year. This year, with the scratch, it made it a little less than what we were thinking about with Maximum Security getting out of there. But it's generally been a good race. And in past years, there's been two PA breds that have won the race. Last Crusade, I think his name was, he won it. He was a PA bred, trained by Pam Shavelson. And I won it on one of my favorite horses, Devil's Honor, PA bred. So you got to love them PA breds.
No doubt. And PA breds available coming up at the Timonium sale on Monday or Tuesday. Monday. And Monday. Yeah, Tony, I got to bring up a name with you because I was kidding him. Had Jorge Duarte on for the first time. And of course, Georgie got the opportunity, really of a lifetime. I mean, to be taken in by, Alan Goldberg and Rich Santulli and groomed and developed to take over the training operation for Colts Neck. It's really a great opportunity. He's making the most of it. And he was talking about, I guess, I don't know if he's talking about, yeah, Farrar and the win over the weekend, about being on the front end. And I said, well, you rode against him and you rode against Tony Black. I said, who's tougher? I said, Tony will be on the Thursday. I said, who was tougher to get by? He says, both of them.
George is a good kid. I can remember when these kids walked in the jocks room and they were little buck boys just starting to learn to ride. Guys like him, years before that, Joe Bravo, and a bunch of names popped to my head. But, yeah, I was real proud. Who said jockeys can't train horses when they're done training? He's done a fabulous job, and that one filly, I can't think of her name, the one that Ferrer won on for him, won like three stakes at Monmouth. I mean, you got to love it. And that was good that Goldberg gave him a shot and groomed him, Santulli and Goldberg groomed him and allowed him to be their main trainer. And I'm so proud of Georgie. I see his mother every morning at Parks. She's in the kitchen, and I see her. And I always say, that's my man Georgie doing, little Georgie. And she always keeps me, up to date on what he's doing.
Nice.
Every once in a while I say, he's going to be here today. And, of course, I miss getting over there to see him. As I've missed the last three shows when you had him on, but I knew you had him on because I looked on Facebook and it mentioned that you had him on, what was it, Tuesday or Wednesday, whatever day it was. And I missed it. But I'm proud of that, Georgie Duarte. He's done a great job. Keep up the good work.
And he was a good little rider. He had nice career. Of course, his dad, big time. I think is he the winningest rider in Puerto Rico history?
Yeah, I believe so. And Georgie comes from a background of racing, and he's upheld the reputation of the family real well. He went, from riding now into training. But I really am proud of him because there really is a mindset out there. You know, once riders quit riding, they don't usually transition well to the training aspect. Yet, lately, in the last few years, or I don't know how many years, we've seen a few riders transition to training. They've done pretty good. You got to be proud of them, especially proud of Georgie. And, my hat's off to Alan Goldberg. That was a beautiful way to let someone make a career change. So my hat's off to Alan and Mr. Santulli.
Well, and looks like they'll continue. Santulli's got a very nice broodmare band, and he's always had a program that kept the fillies and sold the boys. He's doing a little bit. He's doing a little bit of both. Still buying. He's still augmenting. His racing stock, and that filly you were thinking of was Goldwood, the nice turf sprinter that won the Sensible Lady at Delaware, and they split up Goldwood and Booze. Booze stayed and ran in the Turf Amazon. That much like every other turf course in the Northeast. Not just the Northeast, too. I think Kentucky's got the same problem. We haven't had any rain, Tony, in 2 months. Since September. It hasn't rained. And so I went down yesterday to Belmont. Our little filly, Minute Mouse, was in the nightcap. And, I thought she had a very nice chance. But she's really a horse that wants to, just kind of break and then settle and come with a run. But there was very little speed, and knowing how the turf has been playing, he said if she breaks sharp, go on with it. So she chased a very hot pace, and there was no making up any ground for her late.
Yeah, that's the nature of turf courses. When they depend on the weather, they depend on an irrigation sprinkler system. Not always do they have that.
Doesn't help. All that does is keep the grass green.
Right. It doesn't get into the root of the grass. No, absolutely not. You need rain. You need weather and climate that is conducive to turf racing, and we sure haven't had that this year. And the nature of turf racing is turf courses deteriorate under the best conditions as the season goes on. You see the guys walking it, and I was laughing at them the other day. They're walking the first turn of Parks, and they fill in the divots and plop over the cutouts and all that BS, and it's BS. I said, you better fill them in with cement. And they looked at me, and they went, boy, Black, you ain't changed none. You got too much to say. I said, yeah, because all that sand that you pour in there and see and anything else you do is like, I don't want to say exactly what it's like. It's like peeing in the wind. It does nothing. You can fold back over a divot, and the next race it folds back over, and it's wide open. Turf courses, the best of them. They're saying even at Penn National, which is really has a turf course reputation of being fabulous, they get cut up. They deteriorate. Parks Turf Course has a reputation of being horrible, and the reputation always precedes it. It's not as bad as its reputation states. But once it gets to this part of the season, even when they take care of it and do all they can do and limit the racing on it, it's torn up. The first turn, it ain't turf. It's dirt. It's dirt, and that's what we call it. Dirt.
Well, you got a point in the season. What's unusual about this, as October looms, typically, you begin to lose the course because it starts to almost fall apart because of the moisture, and it doesn't dry, and that's the part of it. The temperatures shift, and during the summer, and even frankly in the aftermath of what went on at Santa Anita, one of the topics that came up, and I know Tony, you go to that track superintendents conference,
right?
And you know, one of the topics that was certainly broached in circles that address this kind of thing is the climate issues and
right.
The basic. You know, the extremities that we're seeing in climate, despite some people wanting to refuse to acknowledge it. And the net result is how it affects the turf. I mean, typically by now we've got a much more yielding surface, you know, certainly in the Northeast. And it's rock hard. And there hasn't been a serious soaking rain, I mean, in weeks on end. So I don't know.
It really makes it hard to maintain and keep the turf course at its highest quality. I used to ask some of the track superintendents in different areas, you know, why some part of the year is this turf like so many inches long, you know, maybe four of the grass is 3-4 inches by whatever. You know, we look at it and then a couple inches. And then other times of year, it looks like a carpet out there. And they say, well, we'll tell you what it is, Tom. When we're having dry temperatures, we leave the grass long. This is what a couple of them told me. I don't know. Maybe I'm stating something that's not fact, but this is what a couple of them told me. We leave it long at certain parts of the year because it holds the moisture and it tends not to dry out when we do get some moisture in it because the grass keeps the sun over top from burning into the base, you know, for heating into the base, and it keeps it moist. Now, the only other thing you're dealing with that is it also promotes the growth of fungus when you keep something moist and you're not having daily, you know, cleansing and water and rain on it. Then other parts of the year, because it's so dry at times, they'll shorten the grass. And at some parts of the year, they make it look like a carpet out there. And it's, you know, and it has a lot to do with the temperatures, why they cut it short sometimes, the temperatures, the amount of moisture they're dealing with, and all that plays into it. You know, I've ridden on turf courses that the horse steps down and you can't see his foot. The grass is so long. And then in other parts of the year, it looks like they're going over top of AstroTurf, you know. But that's where a track superintendent has to manicure and deal with his turf course according to what he's seeing in the extended forecast and the daily forecast and the temperatures that we have. You know, it's really a tough formula to figure. Whenever you're dealing on the weather and it dictates to you what's going on, you're dealing with sometimes an unknown variable. You know, you're guessing a lot of times. But they have reasons for cutting it short or letting it grow long, and they kind of explained it to me. And, you know, then again, you know, you have turf courses that are more resilient than others. It's tough. Turf racing's tough.
and the worst part about it, when it comes to the horse playing side, you can't count, and because you guys explain, Tony, too, before we go, explain how the riders adjust, because what ends up happening is you're cognizant that you can't make up ground, and so you take horses, you know, a little bit like what we did yesterday. You know, Benji Hernandez came to the paddock and said, you know, there's not a lot of speed in here, and I don't know, you know, if we can make up ground on the way the grass is. And so I said, well, if she breaks, go on with it, and you know, try to, you know, keep her within, you know, a reasonable amount of distance. So strategically, outfits start to try to adjust to give themselves the best chance, because they know that if you leave yourself too much to do, nobody's going to come back to you. So all of a sudden, as a horse player, you know, you're looking at PPs, you see who is typically near the front, who's mid pack, who's a closer, but yet you're helpless as to how they're going to react to the way the course is playing.
Yeah, I can give you a little story which I can relate to that. One year, Vince Pacalli, who I thought was a world-class rider, great turf rider, good for behind rider, we left Jersey and went to Maryland. We're living together. His dad was a jockey. His dad used to come from Charlestown and come to the races and watch us ride. One day his dad come and he's watching. He stayed a few days. He said, listen, I'm watching these races. You guys are letting these horses run on this turf course. We're at Laurel. You guys, do yourselves a favor. You know, when you ride your horses, take them back on this course according. Take them back. They'll come firing and exploding at the end, I guarantee you. So Liz and I are living together, and we started kind of listening to the old man because he only rode thousands of races, and we figured to Vince Percalli Sr. We said, maybe this guy knows something. We'll listen to him. So we started taking horses back, and we started dominating them. It was, if Vince wasn't winning them, I was winning them. We got into a thing where we used to go home at night and say, I'll look for you last or next to last. I'll get further back than you, Vince. You know, and I was always kind of labeled as a speed rider. He said, you'll never get further back than me. I'm anchoring this son of a bitch leaving. And we were getting as far back the first part of the race as you could get. And we would come smoking past them. They looked like a freight train passing a bum on the side of the racetrack. On the side of the track. We were smoking it. We were winning all the turf races. And we're living together, you know, and neither one of us are married. This is like the early 70s. And then it kind of started figuring out the way turf horses can run on any typical turf racetrack. A lot of times your best turf horses will come from just off of it or come from off it. And turf racing, you can be more relaxed in the early stages. If you can get a horse to relax, most of the time they'll come running. And not always does the pace dictate what they can do if they are behind them. Because turf courses, the footing changes. You know, like you say, when you get turf courses where the footing is hard because of a lack of rain and, you know, it changes. When you get turf courses where they're drying out and they're not even quite slightly yielding, you know, and sometimes they even roll these turf courses. You see the grass is laid over and flat, you know. Yeah, you can ride your horse accordingly. But generally speaking, I always had better success when I would relax early, get them to relax, make a run. And, of course, the mindset is you have to save ground. You know, because most of your turf courses are on the inside of a mile racetrack, unless you're at a mile and a quarter, mile and eighth, or a mile and a half racetrack. So the turns are a little sharper, so if you can save ground and let them, you know, fire at the end when they hit the straightaway, have some place to go, it could be to your advantage. But, you know, you not always can save ground because riders get the same mindset. I'm saving ground. Well, when you got all the horses in front of you, saving ground doesn't do you any good if you're wrapped up coming to the wire because you got no place to go. And that's on any racetrack surface, whether it's dirt or turf. But turf racing is interesting for riders, you know, because if you do ride at that track every day, you can see the change in the way you have to adapt your riding technique, more so to turf than to dirt. You know, dirt, you can more or less ride at times the way the horse wants to run. You can't always drag them in behind horses because some horses don't like to get hit with the dirt. On the turf, you can drag them in behind horses, and sometimes it's either just a very fine spray or a clod here or there that might fly up. But horses don't react in a negative way being behind horses on turf as they do on dirt. It's a different game altogether, and if you're a rider that's trying to play that game, you better adapt to what you can do different than what you do on the dirt.
Yeah, and it is a challenge when, you know, the horse playing side of it, when you're, you know, trying to discern a bias, and you know, we talk about them a lot, and you know, they aren't as prevalent as I think people want to think they are, want to believe they are, because a lot of times, you know, just because, you know, early in a card, you get, you know, two or three winners, you know, let's say down inside, well, make sure, you know, before assuming that there's a bias, make sure that it's not the horse that absolutely figured to win and win, you know, on the inside and you know, let's say wire to wire. I mean, a lot of times when you go and look at it without really thinking, or, you know, let's say you're going to play late in the day, you're going to play the late pick four, you're going to play the late double, and you look at results and you see, you know, so-and-so and so, you know, won, and you think, oh, you know, the inside's got to be good, and it's not that simple. There's more factors than simply, four horses won wire to wire, and so there must be, you know, there must be a speed bias.
There must be
an old rail.
Yeah, you know, you can sometimes the bias that you're noticing or you are thinking it exists is not exactly what exists. It just happened to be the best horses won because that's the way they ran their best races. And, you know, generally speaking, though, you know, people want you to save ground on the turf. Generally speaking, there's some trainers who ride for them want you to save ground every time you ride a horse, whether it's turf or dirt. I'll tell you a little story real quick because I got to make this statement. I rode a horse and it was a pickup mount, Delaware Park. It was I was vying for my 4,500 winner. So I picked up a horse called Revved Up for Christophe Clement. He said, whatever you do, sit on this horse, stay on the inside, don't get off the fence. You know, save ground. Well, I watched Santos ride the horse a couple weeks before that at Monmouth. He saved a lot of ground, and he come to the wire with a handful of horse because he had no place to go. So I rode the horse that day. It was coming up on my 4,500th winner. It was a 200,000 cities for Rodney handicap. And when I saved ground and I come out of the turn, I swung around him and just blew by him and went a 200,000, my 4,500th win. He wasn't happy because I didn't save ground, but I won the race. And that was my 4,500th win, and I never rode another horse for him. But guess what? If you're listening, Christoph, I won 711 races after that without you.
You're ridiculous. And of course, that was for Mrs. Weber, Revved Up.
Yeah, I don't think she minded that I won.
No, she didn't mind at all, I guarantee.
But Christoph didn't like it. But like I said, guess what? I won 712 races without you.
That's pretty funny. That's pretty good. Well, Tony, I really had Tina and I to say thanks again. We got to also, I mentioned coming, you didn't hear me coming into the segment, but everybody loved Petey. What a sweet kid, and smart, and bright and personable, polite. Everybody was just blown away by him.
He better than I was when I was his age. He's such a good boy. I love all my sons, and he's been a blessing. And to have him as my last offspring. And he's a good little boy, and I appreciated everybody making a fuss over him. That made me so proud. Hey, and you know, like I told you, he's such a good boy, I'm not going to send him back. I'm keeping him.
And did you see that picture I put up? Kylie she's a long strider.
Yeah, she got a long stride on her. I saw that. I said, what a picture. I'll save this picture. She got one foot on the ground and one foot in the air, running across the winner's circle. But it was a beautiful day. And, you know, I was so glad that you could be there because I've had some great days at the racetrack. The one day that was a really nice day, but it was a little bit of a downside of a nice day, was when I went to the Hall of Fame induction for my Juliet. And, of course, you were bedridden with the eye, the detached retina operation. So as nice of a day as that was, it would have only been better if you could have been there. I really missed you. And I appreciate all you did for my Juliet and what Steve Askin did for my Juliet. But you being at the Pennsylvania Derby with Johnny D and his wife and Tina, your wife, and my little boy and me made the day a very memorable day. I'll never forget it. And thank you so much for the pictures that you sent. I love them.
Not at all. Tony, love you lots. You're the greatest. It's always one of the highlights, not just of the fall, all year. And we'll look forward to another one, and we'll talk next week.
Thank you, Steve. Keep up the good work, and love you, brother. Bye.
Love you, too. Tony Black, everybody, one and only. Let's take a break. Steve Askin, the aforementioned Steve Askin. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the Pennsylvania Derby, obviously. But and Steve couldn't make it because Joan must that back issue must have made it impossible because they were going to make arrangements. In fact, Kylie was you know, Tony's wife was ready to accommodate Steve and Joan. So we'll find out what went on there. But I'm anxious to hear Steve's thoughts about this fairgrounds tweak. Seems interesting what the concept is here to, you know, shift the distances, make them a little bit longer, including the first domestic test past a mile and an eighth for 3-year-olds, mile and 3/16. So Steve Haskin next. A little bit later, we'll check in with Rich Ang as he gets ready for the Santa Anita season. Get some thoughts going in, and we'll see if Seth is available. Seth was up in Maine, and he was going to head back today. He didn't know what time he was leaving. So if he's hanging around, and it's certainly a pretty day here in upstate New York anyway, so if it's nice in Maine, he's probably hanging a little bit longer. Hopefully he's shopping for a new summer vacation spot for Tina and I to leech off of him. Back after this, Steve Haskin.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're going to love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Horseville's.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horseville's.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horseville's.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horseville's.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years. We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and kept the song on Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood fraternities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade One race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Open up your heart, what do you feel? Open up your heart, what do you feel? Is real.
We're back at the races, 15 minutes to the top of the hour. Steve Haskin standing by, and since we just wrapped up with Tony, you know, we thought there was a chance that Steve and Joan could make it to Parks. They'd been there couple of weeks earlier, but Pennsylvania Derby Cotillion Day. And I know that, Steve, Tony's wife, Kylie, was ready to accommodate, and I'm guessing Joan still not feeling up to it, huh?
No, she wasn't. She wasn't up to it. Almost there, but not quite. She's much better now, but her back was still bothering her, and I guess you figured it would be a long day.
Yeah.
Even though we were offered a table, which would have been nice, but what are you going to do?
No, I know, and you've got a bigger, much bigger, longer trip to prepare for anyway, because you've got the upcoming tours that I see you've been updating everybody, and I want you to run it down, because I saw where you added one to Spendthrift, and this has become, Steve, this has become a real thing for you, and the farms, the stallion farms in Kentucky like it, and the people that get to visit seem to just absolutely love it. Talk about the upcoming trips.
Yeah, they really do. I mean, we've been doing it for a few years. It's been going on before that. Bill Knack was always there, and Penny Tweedy, and Penny Chenery. But Leonard Lusky, who was in charge of Secretariat.com and was Penny's partner, and all merchandising and everything Secretariat. He had to revamp things, and didn't have. Didn't have Charlie Davis anymore because he passed away. So I sort of stepped in. And the last few years, it's twice a year. Once in the fall is the Secretariat Festival in Lexington, based out of different places. And then every March is the Secretariat Birthday Celebration at Doswell, at the event park at the Meadow, where they still have old barns, and give tours there, and I give speeches and a lot of merchandising, and that's a lot of fun as well. This is much more widespread. It's not focused as much on Secretariat, although a lot of the people that show up are all, from different various Secretariat fan clubs, from Facebook, but just, Secretariat fans in general. People come from all over the country, and we get a lot of people there. So we've been doing a lot of tours. We've gone to a lot of different farms. I think the first one I went to was Womack to see the graves of Sham, Risen Star, son of Secretariat. And so I gave talks about them, just trying to tell some inside stories, about these horses and descendants of Secretariat. But, there's always a trip to Claiborne, always. People just love going out to Claiborne, and they do a great, great job now, and then they have a gift shop out there. But this year, we had some, we went back to Calumet, and Calumet's a big thing. That was sold out in two different tours last year for a lot of money, and people paid a lot of money to go there because Calumet is not on any of the tours, and there are some people that may get in to see the stallions there. If you want to see Keen Ice, Oxbow, and those kind of horses, but you can't get back to the cemetery, and that was the big lure to this tour. We went to the cemetery, and I'd do my research and just tell stories about a lot of the Calumet horses and trying to find as many interesting stories as possible. So we got a lot of people, and people, just seeing the graves of Citation and Bully and Whirlaway and Twilight Tear, and I mean, all the Aladar's grave is all by itself under a tree. People. One thing about people love going to cemeteries. I mean, it brings back a lure of the past, which it did me when we went to Claiborne last year for the first time. We got back to Marchmont Cemetery. I did a whole column on visiting Damascus's grave, which is very special to me. I hadn't seen him in years, and his grave is not up by the office with Secretariat and Weaver Ridge and the older graves, Prince Quillo and Nasrula. All the mayors are buried back in Marchmont. Personal Ensign and Heavenly Prize and Inside Information and Storm Flag Flying. I mean, they're my flag. They're all buried back there. along with Easy Goer and Damascus and Unbridled. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing cemetery back there. People don't get a chance to get out there. So, and this year, Leonard Lesky arranged for a trip to Lane's End to see AP Indy. That got sold out immediately. You know, AP Indy. And plus, is, I mean, people want to see Arnicote. Quality Road is a big lure there. Candy Ride's a big lure. I mean, it's, they, obviously, I don't have to tell you about Lane's End. And, of course, we're going back to Claiborne again and back to Marchmont. And now it's, that's just about sold out. And then we have another trip to Calumet again. And I said, well, listen, I thought everybody wanted to go to Calumet has been there. Well, that was sold out. He lowered the price a little bit, but that got sold out. So we just started talking. And then there's other events this year. On Saturday, we have the unveiling of a huge Secretariat statue, because the base this year is going to be at Keeneland, so people can go to the backstretch. But we have the big statue unveiling, which I have to say I'm slightly honored, because part of that statue is based on a photo of mine of Secretariat working out that I took before the wooden memorial, where he's completely stretched out, where his leg is, you know, one leg is as far as it can go in the front, and one leg is as far, two legs as far as they can go in the back. And you can really see it's, you know, and so she used that photo to as one or two or three inspirations for the statue. Anyway, that's going to be unveiled, and then eventually it's going to wind up on a roundabout on Old Frankfort Pike when you're leaving Lexington, and you go around the roundabout. This big statue of Secretariat's going to be there, but they're going to have to arrange like a parking area for people to come. Obviously, you can't stop your car there. So that's going to be a part of it. And then we've got there's several talks. Dr. Cheney's going to be there. Dr. Copeland's going to be there. Not Dr. Cheney. Dr. Copeland's going to be there to talk about Secretariat's abscess, of all things. And then on Sunday was another talk, which I'm going to be part of, talking about the Secretariat movie. And I'm sort of there as the foil.
you didn't love it.
So I have to balance it out. But, you know, they've got the actor who played Ron Turcotte's going to be there. Eddie Sweat's son is going to be there. But we're going to talk about the movie, and I'm going to sort of supply the other side of it. But anyway, Leonard added this tour, and I had suggested it. I told him, I said, you know what? I tell you, one horse that people would actually love to come out and see that they normally cannot see, even though you can get to this farm. But it's, you know, it's like it's like, you know, if you go to Lane's End, but you can't go see Zenyatta. So anyway, we're going to Spencer Farm, but we're going to go visit with Beholder. So I think a lot of people are, you know, excited about that. And it's got a lot of, I put it on Facebook, and it's got a lot of response. So, you know, and it's a quick thing because it's in 2.5 weeks. So, but I got a feeling that they're going to get a lot of people on that as well. Plus, you know, we'll see the stallions. We'll see the famous statue of Nashua and Clem Brooks, and then the big stallion barn with all the nameplates up there. And in fact, I was responsible getting Swaps' nameplate, because when we were there, all the stalls had the nameplate of who was there. And we're talking about Seattle Slough, Affirmed, Raisin Native, Majestic Prince, Sham, Gallant Man. I mean, the you know, list of stallions there, Exclusive Native, that stood there, and all their nameplates. And I said, well, there's no nameplate for Swaps, because Swaps lived out his days at Spendthrift. And Ned Toffee, who's the general manager, had said, well, there's no nameplate because we don't know what stall he was in. I said, well, not only do I know what stall he's in, but I got a picture of him in that stall. It was right before he died. They wouldn't bring him out because they didn't like the way he looked. But it's an outdoor stable. And he had his head out, and I went over and took a picture of him. And I showed Ned exactly where his stall was. And he went out and he ordered the nameplate. So Swaps has got his nameplate.
So
it was... So, and I wrote a whole column about it, about, you know, his Flops finally, you know, finally returned home, you know, found his home, about, you know, from where he was. Of course, Nashua was there, so he had Swaps and Nashua there at the same time. So that was great. And it's just a great stallion barn. And then if you go in the breeding shed, it's amazing. In the breeding shed, they have the names, you know, like little plaques. They have the names of every horse that was ever conceived in that stallion barn. And if I say there are 200,000 names, it's amazing. I mean, we just listen to the names of the stallions I reeled off.
Sure.
So just try and think of, like 75% of the greatest horses that ever lived were conceived in that barn.
It's amazing.
So we got that. And then, of course, you know, listen, go visit some of the hottest stallions in the country. You know, they're Into Mischief and his son, Golden Sense, and Malibu Moon. You know, a lot of young stallions are there now. The horses just came off the racetrack. But those three are descendants of Secretariat, so there's a link there. And so I think Spendthrift's going to be really good. People see where Sham was stabled when he was there. So I'm looking forward to that. So I'm going to have to start hitting the books soon and starting to come up with stories and stuff. I got four tours to lead now. Although I don't have to do much at Claiborne. Claiborne, they just bring out the stallions and people line up. The best stallion who's never been to Claiborne, and if you're a fan at all of Warfront, you know, I don't have to tell you how popular he is. Warfront is the one stallion that they bring out, and people, and I'm talking 30 to 40 people, line up. And each person goes up and does whatever they want to him. You can go up and have your picture taken with him. You can go up and pet him. You can go up and wrap your arms around his neck, which a lot of people do. I got a picture of Joan with her arms wrapped around his neck. He just stands there. He's got like, let 40 people come over to him and do anything they want.
Nice.
With him. Hug him, kiss him. And they're kissing him, they're hugging him, they're petting him. It's amazing. So it's going to be a really, I think it's going to be a really nice trip. It'll be a lot of fun. And then there's like a meet and greet. And then I will actually be up there, it starts Friday night, like with a meet and greet, but Saturday and Sunday, the 2 days, I will be up there Thursday because I'm going to be part of probably about 6-7 people on the panel. It's called the Storytellers, and it's going to be held at the castle near Keeneland. And the famous chef there is going to have a big buffet. It's a fundraiser for old friends. And not only that, but they are putting Joan and I up at the castle because it's now a very, very fancy hotel. If nobody has been to the castle, you have to go look at it, even at night when it's lit up. But it is a castle. I mean, it is a legitimate castle. And you have to read the story behind it. But anyway, so I know Chris McCarron will be on the panel, Rosie Napravnik, Joe Sharp, a whole bunch of other people, too. So, you know, we're all just going to talk about, you know, just tell stories.
Nice.
So we only have like 15 minutes a person or so, so I have to start I figured I might start telling some touch gold stories over time. I'm trying to keep it to old friends, being, you know, it's their fundraiser. So it's going to be a busy weekend, so I'm looking forward to it.
If Steve, is there room still for the last trip that was added to the
Spendthrift? Yeah, sure.
How do they get in touch?
We started selling tickets yesterday because it was a last minute thing, and we had to get an okay. There was no problem going to Spendthrift, but we had to get a special okay to see Beholder. And I know Ned Toffee very well, and I've been to see Beholder on several occasions, and she's a real doll. So I contacted Ned, you know, told him we had a bus tour, and he said, you know, no problem. So that's how we put it on there. So, and that's going to be on Sunday, October 13th.
Yeah, run the dates by for everybody so they can figure out.
It's officially starts off Friday night, October 11th, but it's Saturday and Sunday, October 12th and 13th.
Very good.
Like I said, the other farm tours are sold out. I think there's still a little bit of room for the Claiborne tour, which is on Saturday morning. But Sunday morning's Calumet is sold out, and Saturday morning's Lane's End is sold out. But you still can come to the unveiling. You can go to Keeneland. You can come to you can get a tour of the backstretch, meet the trainers, see the horses working out, get a tour of the racetrack itself, and of course we have the big merchandising. Everything you can think of with regarding Secretariat and Riva Ridge, and there's always somebody there selling sham material too. I try and pop in there and sign my photos of Secretariat that Leonard made into gorgeous 11x14s and 8x10s, and I mean, they came out, I have to admit, fantastic. And they're not your run of the mill photos; they're behind the scenes photos of him at the track and also at Claiborne Farm. And they've been selling well, and I autograph all the pictures there. So, there are still other things too. And then the forums; you can still sign up for the forums if you want to learn all about the inside story of Secretariat's abscess, you know, that he had the Wood Memorial. But Dr. Copeland's only 95 years old, and he's still
sharp
as a tack.
Amazing.
And then Sunday, if you want to listen to the pros and cons of the Secretariat movie, I'll be there to offer my cons. But I won't be mean about it. You know, it's like I said. I grew up watching the Jolson story. That was my favorite movie of all time. I've seen it literally over 100 times since I was a kid. I worshipped Al Jolson, and I just loved the movie. And then later on, I wound up reading the biography of Al Jolson, and there was absolutely nothing in the movie that even resembled the truth, and yet I completely discarded the real story of Al Jolson and who Al Jolson was. And to me, in my mind, Larry Parks is Al Jolson, and what happened in the movie is the life of Al Jolson. So I think a lot of young people now are going to look at it and say, I don't care what the real story is of Secretariat. This is the story that I'm going to go by. So I can understand that. And it's a feel-good story, you know, with all its flaws. So I'm not going to be hostile about it. You know, it has its good points, but you know, anybody who is around and anybody who knows anything about horse racing knows that there's a lot of silly scenes in that movie.
Well, Steve, these have become very popular, and if people can't get to one of the visits that. You know, this go around, then there'll be others, and this has really become a big part of the fall season. So take advantage. How do people, if they want to go to the Spendthrift,
just go to secretariat.com.
Okay,
and you can purchase your tickets. Just go right to secretariat.com, and just go to events, and you'll see. And actually, when you go onto it. There should be a big Secretariat Festival thing there, and there's a whole big page on the Spendthrift, and you can just sign up for it right online there.
Well, let's turn our
attention. Yeah, and also, by the way, let me just say, if for some reason you can't make it this year, next year is the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's birth. So next year is going to be huge. There's going to be a lot of stuff next year.
Plan ahead,
especially for the Secretariat Festival. If you're near Virginia and you've never been there, you know, obviously the farm itself is now an event park, but the Folding Barn is still there, and the Training Barn and the Yearling Barn, and there's still a lot of Secretariat stuff there. The Chenery's house has been redone, but it's now a museum. You can go there and just see a lot of paintings and memorabilia and a lot of stuff with Secretariat and Riva Ridge. And we always have talks and there's always a lot of stuff going on. Last year we went to go see, it's actually not even on the grounds. It's on a private property, but we went to go see something Royal's grave. So next year we'll have that in March. And that's in Doswell, Virginia, where the meadow was, and then next year's festival will be focused around Secretariat's birthday. You know, his 50th birthday.
Steve, let's talk a little bit about a couple of topics. And
yes. By the way, I could not get on the stream today.
Yeah, the stream company, they're showing that they have no issue, and Deja continues to be on the phone with them and playing. And there's something odd that's blocking it. So they're looking at all the various options. I'll tell you what is working is Sirius XM, and those that are listening on a service they pay for, no problem there. So bully for all of you. Yeah.
When I get my new car, I'll have it installed.
Well, I don't mean to bristle, but the people that pay for it are having no issue. The result, of course, the Pennsylvania Derby, I know some people feel like it was chaotic. Yeah, the two horses that were outsiders, they certainly were right within proximity of the three major players. Spun to Run and Math Wizard have been keeping good company and are those sort of mid-season developing three-year-olds that are capable. And, you know, for whatever reason, the Improbable created his own issue. War of Will kind of plugged away, and Mr. Money, I think, kind of found himself in a not necessarily with the trip that they were expecting or wanted, and gets beat on the wire. Your thoughts about what went on Saturday?
Well, it's interesting. I wrote a whole column. The title was "The Pennsylvania Derby." You know, was it a good result or a bad result? And if you look at it on paper, you're going to say, "Well, I mean, first of all, you had Maximum Security, who scratches out of the race, so that takes a lot of the glamour away from the race." Then you've got the new favorite in the race, Improbable. You know, basically losing the race at the start. Acting up and had his head turned at the start, and he winds up at the back of the pack and no business being back there. And then you look at the fact that Mr. Money, who was the second choice, and War of Will, your classic winner, who was the third choice. The question is, did they lose the race, or did Meth Wizard win the race? And on paper, it looks like Mr. Money lost the race, as well as War of Will, because when you go a half a mile in 49-3, when in the race before in the Cotillion, the fillies went the half mile in 46-1. I mean, that's a 17-length difference. And they went to three quarters in 113-4. I mean, there was absolutely no way on earth that Mr. Money, whether he wanted to be on the lead or not, which he wouldn't have been, Improbable obviously would have been on the lead, or Maximum Security would have been on the lead. But anyway, there's no way in the world that Mr. Money or War of Will should have been caught by a 30-1 shot, setting these ridiculously slow fractions. But, you know, Parks is a very quirky track. However, the way I look at it is that I think that rather than take away from it, you've got to credit Math Wizard for coming from last over those fractions. And it's not like, well, they just fell apart. I mean, Math Wizard came home the last 3/8 and 36-2. So, I mean, he came home at 24 flat, 12-2. That's legitimate. I mean, that's a legitimate time. Now, are these the top three-year-olds? No, I mean, there are very few top three-year-olds left, let's put it that way. And, you know, I'm sure you'll see Improbable now go back to probably the dirt mile, and good chance Mr. Money might as well. I don't think either one of them are going to try and stretch out to a mile and a quarter. But, you know, so if you look at the fact that Math Wizard, you know, had been improving. You know, the crazy thing is him coming out of the same $16,000 maiden claiming race as Maximum Security. I mean, that is bizarre. And everything about it is bizarre. You know, if you look at Math Wizard, you know, who his rider was, you know, earlier. You know, Edgar Zayas, who had been riding him in all his big races, he decided to stay home.
He didn't decide to stay home.
Yes, he did. I know you had him on, but I had an hour conversation with Safi Joseph. I mean, because I have this whole story in my column. He said they had not determined whether they were going because they had to see how he was coming out of his work.
So they didn't have a travel arrangement.
If you want it, he says we were able to get a plane because they didn't want to put him on a van and then have to scratch him. He said so. The owner found a flight, so they got him on the flight, and they finally called the agent. And the agent said, "Well, we got a lot of business at Gulfstream that day. We're going to stay home."
Right.
So that's what they said. They decided not to go.
Okay, they decided not to go with the contingencies involved with them not knowing if the horse was even going to go. I mean, so as a jock agent,
he made a jockey switch at the last minute on
Wednesday afternoon, and Zayas's agent had already accepted mounts, and at that point, you know, he's committed. So
I get it. He said, if you don't come, you know, there are plenty of jockeys there. I'll get somebody else. So he felt badly because Zayas had worked the horse, and the horse worked 46-1. So, you know, it was just one of those things. And then you go back, you look at that claiming race he was in. Where Maximum Security won and he was third. The favorite in that race actually had finished second in there, was ridden by Luis Saez, who winds up on Maximum Security. I mean, the whole jockey situation this year has been crazy. I mean, the whole thing of Flavian Pratt, how he wound up on Country House, and just the whole crazy jockey situation.
There have been, when it comes to the 3-year-old and the classics, you think about Johnny Velasquez, you know, getting his first Derby on Animal Kingdom, you know, through a whole series.
Well, that was the craziest situation.
That was
unbelievable. I mean, you know, for anybody who doesn't know that situation, Johnny Velasquez was on Uncle Mo. He was the favorite in the Derby. And then he had to scratch him the day before the Derby, and Johnny Velasquez has no mount in the Derby. And then Robbie Alvarado winds up, you know, in a spill and damages his face, and he had all kinds of injury. And he decided, he had a mount on Friday, he decided to take off his mounts. And Graham Ocean and Barry Irwin said, well, if he wasn't good enough to ride on Friday, we're not taking a chance. And they gave Velasquez the mount, like, right, you talk about it, till the 11th hour. I mean, that was, another jockey situation with Math Wizards, that if you go back to his races when he was claimed, the jockey who had ridden him 3 races in a row back then was Jose Ortiz. And his brother winds up on him in the. It's just one crazy situation after another. So, but it was. It depends on how you look at it. You know, was the Pennsylvania Derby a good race as far as the form and everything? No, because horses that should have won didn't win. Horses that you figure shouldn't have won did win, but it had a great story to it. It's a real feel good story. And Myth Wizards, he's run some pretty good races. I mean, I thought he ran an excellent race in the Ohio Derby. He was getting better. And, you know, people saw his last race in the West Virginia Derby. And as Safi Joseph said, it was one race too many. And he said, you know, in hindsight, he wishes he had brought him home. But what happened is that all the 3 races he had run in, you know, Oak Lawn, Thistledown, and Indiana, we're all in close proximity, you know, all in Midwest. So he just kept them at each racetrack. But he, after the Indiana Derby, he was starting to wear down, and he needed a freshening. And it was just one race too many. And then when he got him back to Gulfstream after the West Virginia Derby, like I said, he worked. He worked a half of 46-1 Breezing, a tremendous workout. And then he came back with another big workout where he galloped. He galloped out like six furlongs in 1:26 and pulled up a mile in 1:40. So, yeah, he was ready to go. And Safi did not want to run him. He thought it was the owner's decision to run him. So I mean, it turned out to be an interesting story and part of a very crazy year for 3-year-olds. But as far as an impact on the Breeders' Cup, he's going to probably go in the Classic. He'll be the only one from that race to go, I would imagine. I don't think War of Will will go, but you never know. But listen, Mathways is going to be a long shot again in the Classic. Even though I would not expect a big field for the Classic this year. I mean, the preps are all coming up small fields. I mean, the Gold Cup with, it got unbelievably small field, 5 horses in there. And there's not a lot of top horses left. And even a lot of these horses, we don't even know if they're going to go. I mean, right now, there's a big question mark with Code of Honor of whether he's going to go. There's a question mark with Preservationist. It's possible the Gold Cup might not produce anything for there if they decide not to go, even if they win. Will Farish has been in this position before with Mineshaft, and he won everything. He basically had a Horse of the Year campaign, and they didn't go to the Breeders' Cup. And Jimmy Jerkins is not one to fly out to California. He's not crazy about it. Neither was Allen. I mean, they did not like. Going to California. They felt their horses were at a big disadvantage. And, there's a lot of thoughts of them putting him away afterwards and maybe pointing for the Pegasus and then the Dubai World Cup maybe. But I don't know. It's a crazy year. And the Classic is just sort of a mess right now. We just don't know what's going to happen. Big McKenzie, we'll see what he does, but a lot of people think, he might not just be as good at a mile and a quarter. He's a horse that a lot of people feel should have won the Met Mile, but he looks to be a mile to mile and an eighth type of horse. He ran a mile and a quarter once, and he couldn't get by Gift Box, and they ran a good race, but he was, a lot of people felt he should have won that race. But I don't know if he wants to go a mile and a quarter or not. Obviously, he can win at a mile and a quarter, but it depends on the company. But is he at his best at a mile and a quarter? That's the big question mark. And we don't know how good, High Power is. So it'll be interesting, to say the least, to see how this Classic shapes up.
You've got the potential for a late still. Bill Mott still saying that they'll consider a late for the Classic. McKenzie a late.
Now that to me, and I know they're going to have. I know they're going to have 3 horses, two horses in there already, if Tacitus runs well. And then you've got Yoshida, there have been talk about him going in there, but they didn't go in the Gold Cup last year off the Woodward. And the thing is that Bill already has Tacitus in the Gold Cup. So it didn't look like they were going to run him, and it looked like that Yoshida was the kind of horse that they would train up to the Classic. Plus, He had one little workout last week since the Woodward, and he really didn't seem like he was ready for the Gold Cup. So he'll probably train up to the Gold Cup. But even if he goes to the Classic, and even if Tacitus goes to the Classic, I mean, we'll see what Midnight Bisou does. But if you have a late, and we'll see what she does against Dunbar Road. I mean, the Spinster's going to be an interesting race. Between those two. But, the latest 3-for-3 at a mile and a quarter. And these fillies if you have a mile and a quarter filly, you don't have much to choose from. You got the Alabama at 3, and you got the Delaware Handicap at 4, and that is it. Yep. Personal Ensign used to be a mile and a quarter, and they changed that. So there's no, these fillies, there are a lot of mile and a quarter fillies out there that are not showing their full potential. Because there are no mile and a quarter races for them. Well, Elite, you can see she's vulnerable at the mile and a 16th and a mile and eighth. She's certainly a grade one filly and wins at those distances. But when she's run up against Abel Tasman and when she ran up against Midnight Bisou, you know, those fillies are quicker than her. And you know, you looked at her race in the personal lens, and, you know, she had a clear lead in the stretch, and she couldn't hold it. Got caught by Midnight Beast, who, you know, was a tremendous stretch run. She just got nipped right at the wire. But in a mile and a quarter, she's won both Delaware handicaps by big margins. She won the Alabama by big margin. She obviously loves a mile and a quarter. In a year like this, if you're not going to take a chance in a year like this to go in the Classic, when are you?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Steve, speaking of distance, before we wrap up, I want you to, I don't know if you've had time to really let it absorb and think about what the ramifications might be. What's your reaction to the Louisiana Derby skein and the changes of the distance, going a mile and a 16th in the LeCompte, a mile and an eighth in the Risen Star in February, and then the mile and 3/16 Louisiana Derby?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I mean, you might think that it might be a little far asking a lot of a horse. I think they're obviously going to keep it. There was one positive thing about it. I assume they're keeping it at the same date, right?
To be more or less, January, February, March, yeah.
6 weeks out, right? 6 weeks out. The Louisiana Derby is going to be 6 weeks
right.
out from the Kentucky Derby.
Yes.
Well, that's where a mile and 3/16 is going to come into play. Because right now, the big knock against the Louisiana Derby is the 6 weeks. I mean, it's very rare. I mean, you can count on half of one hand how many horses have won the Derby coming off 6 weeks. I think I mind that bird. And I think Animal Kingdom. I think they're like the only ones I can think of that won off 6 weeks. It's very difficult to do. But what would help you win off a 6 week layoff?
Yeah, that distance.
Coming off of a mile and 3/16 race.
Yeah.
You got more bottom, more foundation under you. You can and it'll take you a little bit longer, Mike, to recover going a little bit longer. So in that regard, I kinda like it. And I don't I like the Risen Star at a mile and eighth because I don't like mile and 16th races. I can't stand them. Then I find a mile and 16th is sort of a cheap distance, which is one of the reasons why I don't like the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile around two turns, because to me that's like running at a mile and 70 yards or a mile and 16th. It cheapens the race. It's not a true mile race. True mile race is a one-turn race where you've got to run flat out from start to finish. That's what a mile is all about. Miles, two turns, is to me, is meaningless. So these mile and 16th races, they don't tell you anything. You know, if you win the Risen Star at a mile and 16th, you say, you know, that's not even close to a mile and a quarter. It's a long way to go to a mile and a quarter. Do we really know what we have? So I look back again, you know, you always hate to say, you know, I look back at the old days. You know, I look back at the way, at the old preps for the Derby. You go down to Florida, right? You go down, you run Everglades, mile and eighth. Flamingo, mile and eighth. Florida Derby, mile and eighth. I mean, all those earlier preps, and the only mile and 16th race was the Fountain of Youth. But you start looking at the race, the Gotham was a flat mile. You know, thank God it's back to that again. But, you know, you have the Wood Memorial and Bluegrass and the San Diego Derby, which, you know, which you still have, but those early races, the Everglades and the Flamingo, these were run in February and March. And they were mile and eighth races back then, back in February and March. And I think you want to give a horse a little bit of a foundation. I don't think you want to keep running them a mile and eighth, mile and eighth, mile and eighth. You know, sometimes you see horses starting at the Remsen, and that's very early to run a mile and eighth. But if you're going to prep for the Derby, and the fact that horses have so few preps now, you better get a mile and eighth race in there earlier. So I really like the Risen Star at a mile and eighth. And the Louisiana Derby, I think it's going to be much, much more enticing for a trainer to, you know, to go 6 weeks to the Derby. If you're going to be putting your horse at a disadvantage historically, I think the thing you want to do is put more bottom into him and say, okay, I get a mile and 3/16 race into him. Now the 6 weeks is not does not seem as difficult.
I I kind of like it. It'll provide a different avenue for the outfits that, you know, that are in a different place on the development curve with their horse. You know, if you're a little bit ahead, you can go in that direction. I also think that, you know, one of the strangest elements to the fairgrounds winter is the success of the fillies toward the Kentucky Oaks versus the success of the boys toward the Derby.
The lack of success, you mean?
Well, there's marginal. There actually is, you know, a handful of horses that have performed well when you look at the whole horizon, you know, like a Gun Runner, you know, Gun Runner. What was wrong with Gun Runners?
I'm just talking about winning. I mean,
I understand.
Look at the horses that went through the fairgrounds. You go through the LeCompte, the Risen Star, Louisiana Derby. You can't think of any of them. I mean, very few Louisiana Derby winners. You got to go. You know, you go back to a horse like Grindstone, who, you know, just showed up. And back in those days, like when Grindstone won the Louisiana Derby, all the horses that ran in the Louisiana Derby, 95% of the time, came back in the Arkansas Derby. You know, because the Louisiana Derby was run even earlier, so it gave
you
time. So, but now they've sort of put it in no man's land. You know, they don't give you enough time to come back with another prep, so you've got to go a long way to the Derby. And if you're looking at it from, you know, from a win standpoint, horses coming from fairgrounds don't win the Derby. So I think they need to do something to change, and I think we might see a change in that now with these distances. Because I tell you, if a trainer wins the Risen Star at a mile and eighth, they know they're almost there. They've only got an eighth of a mile to go. And if they can go to Louisiana Derby and they can get a mile and 3/16 race in them, they say, okay, now we'll sit on them for 6 weeks and now we'll see what happens. History's not against us anymore because there's no history to go by because the race has never been in a mile and 3/16.
It'll be interesting. I'm anxious. I haven't seen horseman reaction really yet to it, so we'll see what they say, what they think. Steve, big weekend with just an incredible array between whether you're focused on the classic division or any of the others. There's something for everybody, particularly Saturday, and then beyond Breeders' Cup preps, there is so much good racing. I went through it at the start of the show, and Monmouth,
Delaware. The key to the Gold Cup is which race Olympic Village is going to run in. Because if he runs in the ACAC, I mean, tell me who's going to go to the front. Let's put it this way. I shouldn't say who's going to go to the front in the Gold Cup. Who wants to be in the front in the Gold Cup? You have a four-horse field. None of them are really speed horses. I've got blinkers on now, but I don't think it did him any good in his last race. And Preservation is the one time he was on the lead. He hated it, you know. So if there's only four horses in the Gold Cup, it's going to be a very, very strange jockey's race for sure.
Steve Askin, I appreciate it. And a reminder, those that are interested in joining Steve and the fun to be had at the Stallion Tours, secretariat.com, and still room to join them at Spendthrift. Steve, thanks a lot. We'll do some recapping, and we'll have the two-year-olds to look forward to. Should be a terrific Champagne in particular. Looking forward to how that comes together. And we'll
two-year-old races everything. Are going to be great.
Yeah, no, it's all a lot. You better be tied on here. This is the jumping off point. We're going to take a break here. Bottom of the hour. Going to come back. Rich Eng, he's got to be getting ready for the opening day at Santa Anita tomorrow. I want to get see if he's got some opinions yet. And of course, I mentioned the very attractive. The pick five carryover and the Stronach five as well. And two races from Laurel, one each from Golden Gate, Santa Anita, and Gulfstream. Back after this, Rich Eng joins us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Amazing achievements for Pennsylvania breeds on the world stage. Thanks to Finest City, Unique Bella, and Shamrock Rose, PA joins Kentucky as the only state in the past decade to breed Eclipse Award champions three straight years. Add that to our unmatched incentives. Plus, our racehorse development fund can only be used to support PA breeding and racing. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing, this is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
I am a passenger, and I ride and I ride. I ride through the city backsides. I see the stars come out of the sky. Yeah, the bright and hollow sky. You know it looks so good tonight. Under glass, I look through my window so bright. I see the stars come
back.
Out.
The race is one. Yeah, typical segment, actually. Just looking up 25 minutes to the top of the hour, and Rich Eng is going to join us. Rich, of course, getting excited for the start of the.